Sharon B., and a longtime friend. Thank you.
Hi, Sharon Barker, alcoholic. It's great to be here. Thanks to this specific group and the committee who put this on. My sponsor said he's the only one that doesn't have notes. And he said, I said, well, we have to aspire to something, Clancy. You have to be ahead of us on the road. And he said, I'm not bound by facts like the rest of you are. So there we go. I love this. A man's life is not determined by a single failure or a solitary success, but by what he passes on to his fellows. And that's what I think we're trying to do here this weekend. Plus me, I'm trying to enlarge my spiritual life because I too, like everybody else that I'm seeming to rub shoulders with this weekend, is a seeker. And I've just opened my heart and my mind and my spirit to much of what is being said, not just from behind the microphone, but in the hallways and the renewing of friendships. And it feels really good. I feel like everybody's had their turn, and I'm a racehorse getting ready for the gate to open. And now that it's open, I like those horses that don't want to go. My ego, and but my ego is one of those, it doesn't quietly go away, it dies screaming. I have to really work on it. I'm very privileged to do step 8 and 9 because it's been it's made all the difference in my life with relationships, and that's what this these two steps are about, are the relationships with people, our relationships with the world, and our relationship with God, which we have heard much from everybody who's been up here, and I'm sure we'll continue to talk about our relationship with our higher power. But I asked my son, he's in college, and so I asked him if he would look up the word amends for me. And it's his college dictionary, and it had four meanings. And the first one was to modify, to add to or subtract to, like a formal procedure, such as Congress. The second one was to change for the better. And the third one, three down, to remove or correct faults, to rectify. And then he said to me, he said, oh, this is the AA one, Mom. This is what you probably want. Which was the fourth one, which is to grow or become better by reforming. And I thought, okay, that's what he thinks of AA, to grow or become better. And I thought, what a testimony to Alcoholics Anonymous that this kid who's never seen his mom drink or carouse or do much of what I'm very capable of doing, tomorrow as what I used to do in the past, he's just seen a house of compassion and Alcoholics Anonymous, and we've had our moments, and but we've built a life together, and that's what he thinks Alcoholics Anonymous is when it comes to amends, is to grow or become better by reforming. I'm hot, so something about the stage and a 2-drink minimum. I don't know. I got to get it out of my mind. There. But this is the first step where we take it out in the world. We take it out in the world. The other, we've been working with a sponsor, we've been in our, in our room reading our book, or we've been at step studies, or we're, calling our other peers going, is this what step 3 felt like for you? And yeah, those sponsors were so happy. I didn't get it. We were talking with each other, and at the meeting, I know I did my 4th and 5th now, and I know you haven't done yours, and and that kind of thing. But now it's kind of like, all right, we take what we've learned and we take it out in the world, armed with the knowledge that it's going to be all right, And that took a while for me. When I got on my first plane to go home to Iowa to see my folks, my sponsor wrote this, "Faith without works is dead." And then she wrote, "God either is or he isn't. And if he isn't, we're all dead anyway." Oh, thanks a lot. You know, I'm getting on a plane to go home to make amends. I'm afraid to death to fly. And she's telling me, if he isn't, we're all dead anyway. So that's all I'm thinking about on the plane, is I know we're going to go down. But too easy for an alcoholic like me. I'm going to get there and I'm going to, you know, make these amends. But, you know, I want to tell you a little bit about how I broke a few hearts, because it talks about that in here. And, you know, I was the second daughter of some very good people, and the other three are still fine. And I brought a sparkle to my dad's eye. I brought some life to my family. I had, you know, I played the accordion. I played the saxophone. I painted pictures. I won contests. I was in the little Miss Eastern Iowa, on a convertible, waving, and my father's smiling, that's my daughter. And, you know, when I started to come home after I started drinking, it was a little different. My my father was wondering why I wouldn't sit and talk with him anymore. My father was wondering why I would avoid him. My father was wondering, I had so much guilt going because I was doing things that he wasn't going to be proud about. I live my life on guilt. So what I do when I feel guilty is I start to get angry at you because I don't want you to see me. And I started to push my father away. I started to push him away emotionally because I didn't want him to know how I was, what I had become, which was not his innocent, pure daughter who wanted to put a glint in his eye anymore. It was gone. It was over. So I would come home, and my father and I, he would try to talk to me. He would send me to the psychiatrist. I would cut my wrists. He would bring the priest to talk to me, and I got drunk. I got drunk in front of him. I got drunk at the family events. I got drunk at the weddings in front of him. I drugged people home. I would wake them up in the middle of the night because I had a revelation, because I'm drunk and I'm high and I'm changing my name. And my father just didn't understand what was wrong with me, why I couldn't just go through college like the rest of the kids, why he'd come home and a car would be missing. You know, why that I used to go to the bookstore and I had a charge account at the university and I would buy all these things and then I would sell all these things so I would have drinking money. And he had these huge bills at the bookstore from wondering what I was studying, why I had to buy hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth of books back in the late 60s. And now it got to the point where my father and I could not sit together. We could not have a conversation. We could not ride in the same car. We could not look each other in the eye. So the fact that I ran from that and I drank over that and I didn't need, I didn't want to be around anybody who had any authority. I was angry. I was really hurt by a man when I was 18 years old who I was going to marry, and I just started to harden my heart. And so this is what I brought home to my parents, was a crazy, hard, angry, in the dark of night, I was guilty and sorry and sad and lonely. And this is what I brought home. So that when I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, they had tried a lot of things with me. They thought even when I went off to this organic farm that he was a nice guy and they're buying land and, you know, we made maple syrup for Christmas Christmas gifts, and we put our name of the farm and our name on the label, and they thought, okay, maybe this is going to work for her. And once again, you know, I left town and joined the carnival. I mean, they just couldn't understand alcoholism. And I am the only alcoholic that they've ever really seen go through active disease and then get sober close to them. So that when I got on that plane and I had made my list after my inventory with my first sponsor, I've had three sponsors. I've done 3 thorough inventories that were timely with where I was in that point of my sobriety. Right at 1 year of sobriety, right about 5 years of sobriety, and right around 10 years of sobriety. And those 3 inventories were all very effective for changing what I needed to change in my life to move ahead, because there were layers. I had so many layers when I came to you. So when I got on that plane, and my sponsor and I had made that list, and she crossed a lot of people off. I had, you know, there were a couple of old boyfriends on there. One of them that had, well, we had a 2-year relationship of black eyes and knife fights. And I just thought, well, I'm still the victim, you know. Maybe I got to go make amends and tell him I'm sorry that, you know, I kicked him when he was passed out so that, you know, I got the black eyes the next day. But, you know, she said, no, I think we'll leave that one out. We'll leave that one out. And she went through a few other people and crossed them out. And she said, the biggest one I have to do is I have to go home to my family. And so at 1 year of sobriety, she gave me that little note. I got on the plane, and I'm going home to make amends to the family for the first time. And I'm a little over 1 year sober, and I'm scared to death. And it said, you know, we go in a helpful and forgiving spirit. A helpful and forgiving spirit. I was frightened, and I prayed a lot. I know, faith over fear, faith over fear, faith over fear was my mantra. And I said that all the way there, and we're home, and my mother and I had a wonderful talk, and she accepted that I was in AA, because they didn't say it out loud, you know. AA, Sharon's in AA now. But nobody outside the family knew that, really. But my father is a different story. I was home, I think it was a long trip, maybe 7, 8, 9, 10 days, seeing grandparents and some other people, and going to my grandfather's grave. That was one amends I couldn't make. He had been deceased for many years. And my grandfather was the one man that I loved, that I named my son after, that he taught me to fish and taught me to cuss, taught me to spit. I mean, he was cool. I liked my grandfather a lot. And he was dying in a hospital bed 2 miles from me, and I was so high and so drunk at Joe's Place, I couldn't get my butt off the bar stool to go say goodbye to my grandfather. And I felt really bad about that, so she had me write him a letter. And I found the grave, and I read it to him. And, you know, that's one of those things that I didn't know was done. I didn't know it was done until my son was born, and I named him Wesley. I got to name him after my grandfather. And I felt really like maybe that door's closed some, that maybe my grandpa Wesley knows that how much I loved him and that I was sorry I wasn't there when he died. But I was willing. I was willing. And willingness was the key about this whole trip home. And we were home for 10 days, I think it was. And we're putting my bags in the car to come back to Los Angeles so I could, you know, go back to work and my meetings. And my trip was over. My vacation was over. And I thought, you know, I haven't done this yet with my dad. I haven't sat down with my father. That sponsor will kill me. And she talked about louder than your head. Sponsor, louder than my head. She was louder than my head. My sponsor today is louder than my head. I act better sometimes because my sponsor is louder than my head. And I just said a prayer. I said a prayer, okay, God, if this is the time, let it be known. And what was it? It was me and Dad. We were out there putting my bags in alone in the car. And so I said to my dad, I need to talk to you. And my father sat in the Bogalusa, Louisiana jail in front of a lawyer that he hired who took his money. The bail bondsman took his money. His daughter was cuffed and crazy, and he was just trying to help me out, get me out of jail. That's the kind of father I had, that he got on a plane and he brought his checkbook and he showed up. You know, my dad had seen me in that condition. We didn't lock eyes. We didn't hug. We didn't say, I'm sorry I'm this way. I'm sorry my life has turned out this way. And so here stands this man that we have all this history. I have all this history with this man. And I so wanted to always be my dad's favorite. That's why I played the accordion. It wasn't cool then. It's still not cool now. But, you know, I played the accordion so that I could be special in my Czech father's eye. And here's this man putting my bags in. And we had had an okay time. There was not a moment that we were really alone together before this. I don't know if that was orchestrated or just seemed kind of the way it was. And so we put the bags in, and I said, I need to talk to you, Dad. It fell out of my mouth. And he said, okay. And we stood by the car. And we stood by the car, and we leaned both back against the car. And nobody's looking at each other. I'm kind of looking down at my toes because I remember the car was parked on sand. I remember we were both making holes in the sand with our toes as this was happening. I remember that, and I remember the heat on my back, and the car was warm. It was a moment that I remember because it was a real moment for me coming to my father with my hat in hand, with some humility, with an open heart, with some sort of mustered courage from people who believed this would be okay, because I just thought he would just say, you broke my heart, that's it. No, it didn't matter if I was ever out of the will or any of that. It was just I hurt so bad that I had broken my father's heart. And I said to him what I had to say to him. It was pretty scripted, and it was very quick. And he said, Sharon, I just always wanted you to be happy. Silence, that's it. Fine, got in the car, came back to L.A., flew home. My sponsor said, did you do it? And I said, yeah. And she said, good, it's a start. It's a start. So little did I know, you know, it was a start. That better be your new liver calling. What is that? Somebody's phone's ringing. Okay. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. Okay. I guess this, just to start with my family, was going to be any lengths. Some of my favorite quotes are in these, not six pages, Clint, it's 8.5, I think. It says, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. That was huge when I saw that. It was like they snuck in the book in the middle of the night and put that in there. And I didn't see that until I was about 7 years sober. I really didn't. I took 16 four-way hits of Orange Sunshine one night, and I found truth. And I had been waiting for many years to find it again, and it's on page 77. It's right there. And it's not melting or anything. It's right there in black and white. So my sponsor said, okay, you don't forget their birthdays, you don't forget Christmas, you're on time with your packages, you participate in their life, you call them once a week, and you go home once a year. Once a year you go home. So that's what I started to do with my family. And I was still in AA. And life went on, and things got good, and I got married and met Boy Meets Girl in AA campus, and my father and mother came out to the wedding. And I was 2.5 years sober, and my father walked me down the aisle. It was a great day, and he went to a meeting, went to the Pacific Group, and looked at all of you and bought the big book and was pretty impressed. You know, you were looking him in the eye, and everybody seemed to be dressed up and looking nice, and that meant a lot to my dad because the people I was dragging home before were barefoot in February, and so just that you look good meant a lot, and you were very gracious with my father, as you've been with my family, as you've been with my family when I brought them in the middle of you. And he walked me down the aisle at the end of the wedding. I remember he and I sat alone, and I remember he said something to me. Sharon, if you think about doing what you're doing before, think twice, because you got it made here. And I was moving, going through some boxes, and I found a picture at my wedding day of my father and I sitting alone, and it was that moment. And I remember that moment because I had one of those Peggy Lee, is that all there is, at the end of my wedding, you know? Just happens, can't help it. And I had my chin on my hand, and I had my wedding veil on, and I'm looking at my father, and my father is talking, looking at me eye to eye. And it struck me, that's kind of when it started. That's kind of when it started. At about 2.5 years sober, he was able, and I was able, to look each other in the eye. It's a precious little picture. And I got another sponsor about 5 years, and I was having a fight with my husband, and, you know, I had done an inventory with her, and we were talking on the phone. I said, he's being mean to me or something, and Jenny said to me, she said, well, how's your relationship with your dad? Okay, I'm fighting with my husband, relationship with my father. Somehow that must mean something. I don't get it, but she said, why don't you call him up and ask him if your job is good now? You make him more money. Pay him back the money you owe him. I know you owe him a lot of money. I was like, I don't think that was in my inventory with her. I don't know quite how she got that. So I called him up, and just to be dutiful to that sponsor, because she wouldn't be quiet about it, and I asked my father if I could, you know, Dad, I'm at this point where I can pay you back some money, and I'd like to do that. It's financial amends. And he said, okay, it's this much, and he gave me a figure. And it says on page 78, most alcoholics owe money. And it also says in there, sometimes we must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we're liable to drink if we're afraid to face them. It says a couple of things in there about drinking if we don't have this experience with the steps, if we don't go to these people and with some humility and with some preparation and with a mindful heart about it, armed with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and not making it about me. The whole thing about the amends in my life is that it's not about me. I have had my time out there. I have had my fun out there. And I hear people say, if I would have known I was going to have to come to AA and make amends, I might have acted better. No. I had a great time with alcohol. If it could have kept going, it could have kept going. But I bottomed out with a broken spirit and a broken jaw in 1975, and I'm grateful I bottomed out. So he told me most alcoholics owe money, and okay, this much, and it was very high. It was a high figure. It wasn't anything like I thought it would be. It was more than triple what I thought it would be. And so I called my sponsor back, and I said, he's ready. He had a calculator tape there in the book, you know. I know he circled it in red. That's the way my father is. He had an office. He had a dossier on me. My brother saw my file. He said it was inches thick. It was documented. That was my dad. My dad was about keeping the record straight. My dad was about, you know, I'll do for you this, and we've got a contract, and you took this, so you owe me for this. My dad was about that. That was my dad. That's why these financial amends were so important to a man of his generation. And it wasn't that I was very cavalier about it, and I said, okay, Dad, not a problem. I said, okay, you know, 2 days I called him back, and I said, these are my payment terms. I came with somebody. It talks about having realistic terms, and I had realistic terms with him. I discussed it with my sponsor. And he accepted my terms. And so I set about doing that. I set about making those amends. My father of that generation got that check in the mail on time, consistently. Because another thing about this set of 8 and 9 steps is that we're an example of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it may be the only example these people are going to see, and we don't know where that example is going to lead. We don't know where this act of step work and some sort of contriteness and spiritual step that we are taking here, trying to rub out the record, as Chuck C. said, rub it out. It's not erase it, it's rub it out. We get to rub it out so something new can come in. We get to rub out the record. Try rub something out. It takes some muscle. It takes some work. It's the harder they are for me, the more my head has been able to have freedom from the guilt. So I consistently was an example of Alcoholics Anonymous, a good example by sending my father that check on time. You know, I had a sponsor that knew more about this step than me. I had a sponsor who had been down the road of life in sobriety and knew that there were healings that could take place. I had no idea. And what happened was my sponsor said, you know, are you willing to really heal this up with your dad? Okay, I'm standing here in a corner. I can't move. She's asking for one more thing. In order to get out of the corner, I got to comply. Yes, ma'am, what do you want? And that's a good sponsor. Waits for you to get a little cornered, and then they ask for that one more thing. And she said, I want you to put a note in with that check. Do not send your father the cold, hard cash. Tell him about your life. And I argued with her a little bit. I said, you know, he's got my sister, the Mensa, the perfect one. You know, they discuss finance. She retired at 50. She's a bright girl. I've got my brother working on a doctorate. I've got Sally, Nurse Sally, who wanted to be a nurse, grow up and live in Alaska at 4, and that's what she did. And then there's me. He wants to hear from me, the alcoholic. I just went to the prison. We just went on this panel, working with this new girl who's right from the streets. She's got 2 teeth left, but we're having a good time. And she going to these meetings, making... I'm cookie girl, you know. She said, I don't care. Do it anyway. Whew, all right. So I sent, you know, and they remember, did you send the note with a check? She'd say, were you on time? Did you send that note? He did. It was a little tiny note, little tiny note, little tiny note. I didn't know what to say to my dad. It was hard. It was really hard to open up my new life, my new given graced life with my father, thinking it's not enough, it's not enough, it's not enough. But he got the check on time, and he got the note from me consistently for 4 years and about 8 months, consistently. And I remember I didn't have any money for a month. And I said, Ginny, I don't have the money this month. She said, send it anyway. It'll work out. Besides, he's putting it into a trust fund for you. And you'll get the money back with interest at the end of all of this, probably. So I sent it early for a couple of months, thinking, trust fund, trust fund. This is better than a savings account, trust fund. I would write the payment number in psychedelic colors on the memo pad, thinking on the memo side of the check, thinking he'll go, oh, it's payment 48. Oh, that's done. She's just been so good. Oh, payment 48. Oh my God, I should give her some back. Payment 48. Payment number 48. But I sent it anyway, and he just probably thought I was being colorful and artistic. So after 4 3/4 years of me doing this consistently, it seemed like somewhere in there, if my father answered the phone, he didn't have to hand it to mom so fast. That maybe we could talk about something in my note, or a note from previous, which made me know he was reading them, instead of the weather, because the weather was safe. And he got this consistently. A man of his generation, it meant a lot. It meant I was changing. That something about that AA was changing my daughter. And he was respectful about it. And he called me between Christmas and New Year's. And I love that time of year because I can almost place myself in the room when I got the phone call. That my father picked up the phone, looked up my number, dialed it himself. And my then husband answered the phone. He said, it's your dad. And handed me the phone. I thought my mother had died or something. My father never called me. And what he said was, Merry Christmas, Sharon. I've been going over this. And I don't want your checks anymore. I don't want any more money from you. That's enough. And it was, you know, at the moment, I was like elated for that. I don't have to send him any more money. This is great. He let me off about 2.5 years light. You know, we calculate that. We're very quick to calculate that kind of stuff, like it means anything. But he said the words that made the Christmas elves cut the chips off my shoulder. And Ralph talked about walking a free man, and I didn't know that was going to happen that day. And he said, don't stop sending me your notes. I don't want your money, but don't stop sending me your notes. And those chips just fell on the floor. I didn't even know I was carrying them around. What happened from that was I stood up straight and tall around the male population after that, not even realizing something inside me had healed. Something inside me was different. Something inside me was more whole. Something inside me had more purpose. And I began to believe you more. It was in my life it had happened, and I get to be the daughter that my dad always wanted, the one that left when she started drinking. And I didn't just get sober and come back and be the daughter. I got back in because of the amends step, because of consistency, because of a sponsor that believed in it, because of a sponsor who wanted more for me than I thought I could have with my father ever, ever, ever. I got to go back to New Orleans in 1980 to the International. And that was a huge thing for me because I lived and died in the French Quarter from about 73, 4, and 5. And we had the International Convention there in 1980. And I felt like, okay, I can go back to New Orleans armed and dangerous with a whole plane load full of Pacific Group members around me, and AA is in town. So maybe it will be okay, and I got to go back to New Orleans when I was almost 5 years sober. And just what you had done with me physically spoke louder than anything I could have said. So I walked around the French Quarter finding some people that I needed to find. I went over this with Ginny. Ginny was my sponsor at this time. I wrote down some people that I had to find and I had to make amends to. And one of the bosses, I had to give him back some money because, you know, he supplied me every single night with a lot of pocket change. He was very generous to me, but I took what I needed all the time from him. And the word was out in the street. You should have seen what that ANA has done with Mama Cher. That's who I was. And those people that I used to drink with didn't recognize me. I didn't have to say anything, just what you had done with me physically, showing up with all these AA people in tow, but that there was a light in my eyes, that I was cleaned up, that I had, you know, lost 30 pounds, that I wasn't sick anymore, that I had friends, that I walked with lightness in my step. All they saw was the package. You know, they didn't really understand, but you should see what that ANA has done with her. She looks great. And that was the word out in the street. And I stood in front of one of my old roommates who didn't recognize me anymore. I had to tell her who I was. I got to 12-step one of my old pals. I was further down the road of alcoholism than these women were. And, you know, I took the book out, and Robin came to my room. We were at the Hyatt by the convention center, the Superdome, and she came in my room, and she was drunk. She could hardly walk down the hall. She laid on my bed and passed out with a big book in her arms. I thought, okay, this is a really good amends here, you know. But I was willing. I was willing. And, you know, she kind of came to, and I gave her the book, and she went wherever she had to go, work a bar. And a couple years later, Robin called me and told me that she had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I get to sponsor her today. And the joy of that is that she has carried on what I have given her. She has given it to so many down south. And that has gone on and on and on. You just don't know where it ends. It's like with my father. You know, the town drunk came to him and said that his wife was being mean to him or something. And my dad said, "Why, you're a drunk. You need to go to AA. It's helped my daughter. It'll help you." You know, my dad's been to one meeting, read the book, and he's... You don't know where this is going to end. And the town drunk got sober. And I got to go find that boss, Dutch, the one that I took the money from night after night after night. And I did find him, and I did talk to him. He didn't want to hear it. He'd stop me. I said, "Dutch, this is important to me. Please let me say this." And I would start again. And he would, no, he was German, and he was very, very stubborn. He wouldn't let me go past the point where I was trying to give him the money. He would always push it back, and he wouldn't let me. And so I was kind of frustrated, and I left. I went somewhere else, and he was following me all night long. He was following. Wherever I went, there was Dutch. And I'd see him again. I'd go, "Dutch," and I'd try, you know, and no. But he was following me, and I said, finally, I said, "You know what? What do you want? What do you want? What can I do for you? How can I make this right? It's important that I do something because I took from you. How can I give back to you?" And he said, "What I want you to do is every time you're in town, I want you to come to my bar, let me buy you a Coke, and I want you to come in my bar and tell me you're still with it." Okay? With AA is what he meant. But with it. He couldn't say AA. With it. So I did that. Every time I went to, back to New Orleans, I went and found Dutch, and I had a Coke, and still with it, Dutch. Good. Great. And then that wasn't good enough, you know. I started to hear people going to New Orleans for sober people for a convention or something for work. So I would say, you got to go by Fritzl's and tell Dutch I'm still with it. You know, take this note to Dutch. So, and these are the meetings you can go to in the French Quarter. So people would go by Dutch. He probably got 100 people he had never known before walk into his bar and say, here's a note from Cher. Cher, she's still with it. Just Sharon told me to stop by. She's still with it. So before he died, he probably met 100 of you. But that's those are some of the good amends. There were some I couldn't make. It talks about some, you know, some we can't make. And a friend of mine, whilst drinking, lost his life, and I was with him. And that was something that haunted me a lot because I was in a blackout. And I'm a blackout drinker, so if for the rest of my life my purpose is to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and the people about me, then so be it. Because I've been blessed to sit in the rooms with you a day at a time now and to continue to not get brittle and old and judgmental. I have to stay in the realm of the Spirit. I have to stay in the seat. I have to stay teachable. I have to be willing. There are going to be many people in life, on my deathbed, they would say, okay, these, and these you didn't do because you didn't remember. You were in a blackout. I hope to God I would feel like I had done everything I could up until that moment. With the next person standing in front of me, God's kids needing other things, just Sandy said, it's God's kids helping God's kids get things done. Now, and that's my job, and I have to stay out of the judgment of that, whether it's somebody I love or somebody I don't love, whether it's somebody I know or somebody I don't know, whether it's somebody in AA or somebody who's not in AA. I have to fit myself so I keep my eyes open, so on a daily basis, since I'm a blackout drinker, I can make living amends, plain and simple. And I'm glad I know that at a gut level. I'm glad I know that in my heart and in my life because it keeps my eyes open. And this guy Michael, I didn't know how to make amends to him. I didn't know what to do. He was on my list, and you know, I had to stay willing. I had to stay open. I thought I caused it. I didn't know what had happened. And one of the ladies from the French Quarter that I used to be roommates with that got sober, another one, I went to visit her. I went to see her. I went to tell her I was sorry about some things that had happened. I asked her how I could make it right, and she said, you know, just be a good friend to me in AA. She's the one who sent me my pardon from the state of Louisiana. I was a felon for fun and for free. I didn't ask for it. She said, I want you to meet somebody. The last time I went to see her, and she took me to this man who lived below us. She was my roommate when this had happened, and this man was killed on Mardi Gras Day, and I was in a blackout. And she said, I want you to meet someone. He was sober in AA, and he had lived below. He had lived downstairs from the apartment I was living in. He had lived downstairs from my friend Michael, who was shot by the policeman on Mardi Gras Day. He heard everything that happened between the policeman and Michael. He heard the conversation. He was in the door in the apartment below, and he sat there and told me what happened. He sat there and told me what happened and that I wasn't in the hallway and that I wasn't out there, that I was probably inside, passed out on the floor, that I don't remember. But he told me I wasn't there, and he told me what happened. And I was just willing. I was willing. I didn't know how to make amends for this. I didn't know what I had to do, and I was told the story of what had happened. And I was able to, of course, let that go because I didn't know. I didn't know I wasn't involved in the killing of my friend. Another situation, I used to lose a lot of animals out there. I was always burying a dog in City Park at 2 in the morning, digging a grave that had been hit by a car in Biloxi because I wasn't paying attention. I was drunk calling him across the road. Another dog killed in the snow in Iowa in the trunk of my car for a week because I couldn't believe she had died. because I let her out and I was drunk and I didn't go let her back in, and she was in a strange place at my mother's house. I was always burying these animals, and you know, they were on my list. You know, my turtle crawled through the white powder and kind of got stuck halfway, and well, he had a smile on his face. He was happy. And she said, you know, you'll get a chance to do that. Something will come up and you'll get a chance. Well, in the first 5 years of sobriety, I wasn't allowed to have any pets. And it's like I was willing. And it's almost like the next week, I'd drive down the street to pick somebody up and this dog is in the middle of the street and it won't leave. And I would try to go around it and it would go sit. It kill me or take me is what it's saying. I'm coming with you or you're going to run over me. So I'd open the door and it got in. And it was a flea-bitten, mess, stinky dog, but happy to be with me. You know, I was like, I can't take you home. I don't know what I'm going to do. And I called my sponsor, and she said, well, just go give it a bath and put an ad and find it a home and sneak it in for a while. So that's what I did. And that little dog got a home in Beverly Hills. He got a good home. And things like that were happening with animals, and I have to find them homes. And I have today I can have pets, and I have rescued animals, and a dog and three cats, and now Casey had one, so we have a dog and four cats, and they're all rescued animals, and they're all grateful, and they all meditate with me in the morning, and they're terrific, but because they get fed after we meditate. So, and I find more, and I find homes, because I'm full up to here, but you know, making our amends, it talks about the alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. That was me. I'm not a tornado roaring through the lives of people anymore. I'm not... my Creator, I've asked my Creator to show me the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love, and I can't expect forgiveness if I can't forgive. And one of the big ones was my Clancy became my sponsor about 10 years of sobriety when my second sponsor, who's doing well now, smoked some pot and gave up 21 years. And right about that time, this was before I did my third big inventory with my third big sponsor, Clancy. I did one with Janet, I did one with Ginny, and I did one with Clancy. And the reason I did one with Clancy is because my husband had an affair with a newcomer in the room, and it was painful, and I wanted nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt betrayed. It took me 7 years and doing a lot of amends to put that victim cloak back up, to quit reacting from guilt. The thing between me and my dad, when that healed up, I was able to work for men without feeling defiant and angry and rebellious and like I have to get over on you or show you something. I was in a good space in my life, and that happened, and I was in a lot of pain. And Clancy said, I got to walk through it with dignity and grace so I can be an example to others. And I did one night when he told me that, I gave up the keys to the car because I was going to drive my ex-husband's car on the beach and let the tide come in. I had started shoplifting because I was just, I'll show them how much pain I'm in, I'll get put in jail, and then they'll all know. It's humiliating when you're 10 years sober and you have to go back to the Broadway and make amends. I was changing price tags at Save-On. It's humiliating. I mean, those guys don't, they just take your money, yeah, thanks, fine, you know? It's like to get to the point to have to talk to somebody about it was, there was a lot of humiliation. So what happened after all of that humiliation that year was I got some humbleness again. I think humility is what's left when the pain is removed from humiliation. And I got humble again. And I did that inventory with Clancy, and he told me that I was going to have to, that someday I was going to have to forgive that ex and her. I just thought, yeah, sure, it's good for you, but it'll be a cold day when I do that. And I sucked it up, and I went through my life, and my life got good, and And I had gotten friendlier with her, and Angie talked about biting your tongue, so I couldn't. He said, you can't say anything when your son gets in the car after he's been with them for the weekend because she bought him something nice, and he tells you about it, you bite your tongue. You don't say anything. You do not want to make amends to that girl for saying something to your son about her. And he was right. Boy, I bit my tongue. I didn't want to make amends to that girl, that second wife. So I would bite my tongue bloody. And so she and I got to be pretty good friends, believe it or not. And he went on to wife three, and she told me that I was her example of walking through it with dignity and grace. She knew she could get through it because she had watched me go through it when she took him from me, that I was her example. And again, I thought, okay, great. He married wife number three, and, you know, I still had that feeling of deadness when I would look at him, and that feeling of sorrow, a little bit of sadness. There was sadness when I would look at him, and I still felt betrayed, like the victim on a dark night. I did. And he had, on my son's first communion day, he had a heart attack, this ex-husband. And we didn't know it, but I got a call later on the day that he'd been taken to the hospital, and they were doing the angioplasty and all of that, and my son wanted to go see his dad, and I thought, you know, and my sponsor said, you go, you take your son to see his father. And so, okay, for the good of my child, I will go. And my son went in there and talked to his dad. He had tubes and all that, and my son was fine. Hi, Dad, how are you? And my friend Cindy was in the room, and she took Wesley to get something to eat, and I was in there alone with Al, and I just thought, oh, I wanted to pull a tube or something, you know. No, I'll just take that off, Emma. But he started to have leg cramps, and he was in a lot of pain, and he was writhing about, and I just thought, oh, my God, I don't know what to do here. Leg cramps. Okay, I know what I do when I have leg cramps. You rub it towards the heart. So I just lifted up the covers, and I started rubbing his calves towards the heart. You know, as I'm, nurse. And something came over me. I forgave him. And he was a child of God at the moment. Now I can dig that one up. That's one that I can still dig on up. But I leave it alone. I bless it. I the judgment about all that, I have to leave alone. I don't understand it. Good. I don't understand it, so maybe I don't have to do that. I can leave it alone. So that has been a long process, because I don't know what it feels like to be a victim and 30 years sober. I mean, it feels heavy, and that itchy wool coat in the back of my closet, that victim cloak, when I take it out and put it on now, I know the difference. It's weighted. It's heavy. I don't like it. I have the sunlight of the Spirit to walk in. I don't have to go there. I have a sponsor that louder than my head and is down the path further and has the lilt and the light of Alcoholics Anonymous in his step and in his life, and he's not doing time here. He is useful and purposeful, and I want that. I know how to do time. I don't want to do time in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm with the seekers. I'm with the ones that are having a good time. I know we've all had amends made to us, like I had one made to me at one day at the yard. Somebody came up to me and goes, you know, I'm supposed to make amends to you. I don't like you. I never did. But I'm making amends. I kept my fists at my side because I've learned to do that. And I just said, okay, where do we go from here? And she said, I'm going to try to get along with you. I said, good. Accepted. But I learned something from that. I learned how it felt to be in the other end of some selfish, self-centered, doing the best she can amends, you know? It was an interesting experience. The chains have been broken. Ralph talked about a free man. The chains have been broken. I get to walk into the world on a daily basis, a free spirit. My chains are of my own making today. The whole thing about my dad and my mom was that by making amends and being an example of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I allowed them to be able to give back to me, which is what parents want to do. I want to give to my son, no matter what he's like. I mean, I love him. He's my kid. And by being who you had me be, when I went home on those trips, when I called them on the phone, when I sent them the presents, when I showed up, and I went through this messy divorce at 10 years, and my car died, and I had no car to drive, and, you know, my son has night tremors, and it's a hard time. I was having a hard time. And I think they caught that on my voice, in my voice when I called home to Iowa. Because about a day or two later, I got a call from my dad, and he said, "We found a car, got it at a good price. We're going to drive it out. We're going to see you in a few days." For fun and for free. They were able to give back to me because you had put me in a place in their life to be their daughter again, that they could love and take care of again. So they got to do that, and they drove the car out, and we painted the house and got rid of the bed and got a new bed. And they didn't say, "We're coming here to help you." They just came and did it. And I think about that. I think about that because the chains were broken. The chains were broken. And we were free with each other. And I got a lot of good years with my dad. And many of you know, 6 years ago when he was killed in a tractor, went over him and his land. And it was over. And when I got the call, it wasn't like, I should have made those amends. I should have gone home and told him. I should have written those checks. When I got the call was, all I thought of was I didn't get to say goodbye. That was the freedom that you gave me. I didn't get to say goodbye. And forever grateful to the sponsors that have walked me through these steps about not making them about me, the amends, hat in hand. Meditate on the matter, the specific matter, if I must, before I go. The love of the people who care about me and Alcoholics Anonymous behind me, armed with that and God, I can go out in the world and do anything. And I can rub out the record. It took some work. A few years ago, I was talking in Westlake, and a girl came up to me. I'm going to close with this because you never know where these end up. You never know where they go. And this girl came up to me and she said, "I happened to talk about my dad 12-stepping the town drunk in Mount Vernon, Iowa." And she came up to me and she said, "What was that man's name?" And I was told her, curious, "John Smith." And she said, "That man is my uncle and he is still sober." And I went home a couple of years to a family reunion. I live in California now, but that uncle 12-stepped me, and now I have 2 years in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Little do we know. Little do we know. On a daily basis, I get to walk down the sunny side of the street with you. I get to be one of God's kids and walk out into the world I still don't understand, armed with the love of a God who is so huge. He's big enough. God is big enough for everything. And give the best, because that's what you've given me, is the best. Life could be so sweet on the sunny side of the street. Thanks for having me.